Welcome to the Strong Starts podcast with your hosts, Jessica Whitehead and Sarah Gerber-Kai.
Hey guys, welcome to the Strong Starts podcast. Thank you all for listening and subscribing and for following us on social media. We are at Strong Starts Podcast at Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. And since we're going to be talking a lot about behavior on this show, we figured we'd spend an episode just defining behavior and giving us some context for how we're going to be talking about behavior in future episodes. So, Jessica, can you start us off? What exactly is behavior?
Well, first of all, I'm very excited to be talking about one of my favorite topics. And I'm glad that we get to talk and define it and discuss it together. So when we talk about behavior, think of it as anything a person actually does: sitting, jumping, breathing, laughing. It's basically anything that shows we are more than just a decorative houseplant. And in the ABA, we also use the dead person's test, which was created by Ogden Lindsley in 1965. And it says that anything a dead person can do isn't behavior. According to the Cooper book, also, all behavior must be observable and measurable. So we actually have to be actively doing a behavior. So, for example, if we were to say the student does not follow directions, well, a dead person won't follow directions either. Instead, we would look at the actual behaviors that lead us to determine that the student is not following directions. Example behaviors could be saying no, turning away, putting their head on a desk, crossing their arms in front of their chest. And so when we see those things, we determine and come to a conclusion that that is not following directions. In addition to that, behaviors are learned over time as a way to get needs met. They happen as a result of a history of consequences. And this goes for all animals. We see this in training, when we're training dogs and we're training horses. When we do something and there is a result, we learn behavior. Then we either learn to keep doing that behavior, change the behavior, or stop doing it altogether. Think of a toddler in a high chair that accidentally knocks their spoon full of baby food onto the floor. And if you're a parent, you've probably had this happen, and you may or may not even clean the spoon, depending on if it's your firstborn or your thirdborn. But either way, you probably rush over, you pick it up, and then you scoop up some baby food and put it into the toddler's mouth, and you ooh and ah and talk about the baby food. You give them attention, and that baby just learned, or the toddler just learned, that knocking over the spoon equals, hey, my parent feeds me. And they just learned a behavior that helps them get their needs met.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, does that mean then, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but does that mean then that like a behavior that I might have in my mid-30s is potentially something that I've learned over like years or even a lifetime?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And a behavior you learn as a toddler can morph and change as you develop. We learn other ways right now to get our, well, maybe, hopefully, some of us have learned other ways to appropriately get our hunger needs met. And so we learn over time what happens as a result. And so we could change that. And we do have behaviors that are rooted from very early on. But then we also sometimes group specific behaviors together under a single label. So one example that I hear often, especially in the school setting, is tantrums or outbursts. Yes, a person might be having a tantrum, but that in itself is a collection of behaviors like crying, stomping, and screaming. Other examples include being overstimulated or defiant or aggressive. This isn't just for problem behaviors, but it's also done for acceptable behaviors as well. And so, Sarah, I'm sure that you see this too in the SEL world, especially when we were talking about being anxious or angry. I'm sure you hear that too.
Oh, definitely. Defining behavior becomes a tricky thing. And for all of my special education teachers, case managers, related service providers out there, we definitely see this when we're creating goals. I see this a lot when I'm setting therapeutic goals with clients in counseling, particularly like teenagers and young adults who come in to a session and say, I just don't want to feel angry anymore. I don't want to feel anxious or sad anymore. And being sad isn't a behavior. feeling anxious isn't a behavior. And so often we'll work through a self-awareness exercise. And this is something that's really helped me, even when working with younger students, just to try to learn these concepts that you've been teaching me, Jessica, about how to observe behavior. And I'll say, okay, well, imagine I'm a fly on your wall while you're feeling sad or anxious. What would I see you doing? And that helps us to come up with some realistic goals that are around the actual observable behaviors that may be contributing to feeling sad or just reinforcing those feelings of sadness. And you have to look at what behaviors are actually indicating that that person is anxious or sad. Are they wringing their hands? Are they breathing rapidly? Are they crying? Pushing papers off the table? Now, I know that at the same time, I've personally and professionally experienced some frustration with this because, you know, when I have a behavior that I want to change, I just want to change everything all at once. Like when I notice that I'm less productive, I just want to be able to wake up the next day and be a more productive person. And then someone like Jessica, who knows all the things and does all the things, will come and remind me, Sarah, that's not how it works. Being productive is not a behavior. It's a group of behaviors that you can work on, like getting to sleep earlier, waking up earlier, eating a healthy breakfast. And it can feel like a lot. It can feel like kind of overwhelming sometimes. And I do find that that tends to lead me to judge behaviors more often than I'd like to. So, Jessica, is there such thing as good and bad behavior?
Well, yes and no. The term behavior, first of all, can be used for both positive and negative behaviors. And it's usually dependent on the context of the situation. So when we hear someone say something like, I had to deal with a lot of behavior today, well, that's a good thing. People should be having behaviors throughout the day. But if the behavior was unacceptable for the situation, we might say we had to deal with some problem behaviors today. But how we determine problem behavior is tricky. We have to consider the social validity and the context of the behavior. And what does that mean to be socially valid? Socially valid behaviors refer to the social importance and acceptability of the behaviors to the person and to the stakeholders. So yelling might be a socially valid behavior when there's a fire, but it's socially invalid if you're in the middle of math class and the teacher is teaching. So we really have to consider the context of the behavior in order to determine if it's a problem behavior or not. And so one example we see in our setting, which I wish we saw less of, is eloping. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're running off to Vegas to get married in an Elvis chapel. But we talk about students eloping. They're usually running to something or running away from something. And it's usually out of an area of permission. So one thing we see is students trying to run out of the building for some reason. And that is a problem behavior because it's dangerous. But it's hard to classify eloping as a problem behavior 100% of the time. If a student elopes from school into the street, that's a problem behavior. It isn't a problem behavior if they're eloping because they are in danger and they're trying to escape danger. And that's one reason why it's so important to not just teach a behavior, but to teach the why and when of the behavior as well. We really need to teach students and people that context is important.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can think of a lot of behaviors that we do at home that would be socially invalid at work.
Oh, yes.
Right? So sometimes when we're putting this into practice, we'll sometimes frame this also in terms of what is working for you, especially when we're talking about this among like older teenagers or adults. We do this a lot in therapy. And one context I like to think about is social validity in the context of having disagreements with someone that you're very close with, like a significant other. It's something that comes up a lot in counseling is how to disagree with people and how to talk about it, especially people that are important to you. And so let's give an example. Maybe every time I have a disagreement with a partner, I get really quiet and I don't respond and I just kind of wait for the disagreement to fizzle out and for us to move on. And it might be hard for us to determine just as a fly on the wall if this behavior is socially valid because we could look at it a couple of different ways. We could look at it as, well, I'm becoming quiet so that this doesn't become a bigger problem so that it doesn't result in more yelling or throwing or a much bigger disagreement. We could also see it, though, as I'm getting quiet to avoid discomfort and to avoid the deeper issue, to really get to some conflict resolution. And so instead of asking, the way I frame it for myself is instead of asking, is this socially valid? I'll ask, is this working for me? Is this meeting my goal? Is this serving me right now? And maybe that behavior used to work for me. Maybe it helped to protect me from fights or scary things that happened when I was a kid. But now that I'm working on some things and I'm trying to learn how to resolve conflict in a healthy way, a more productive way, this behavior of getting quiet is not working for me anymore. And so it would be something that we might describe as a behavior that we want to change or as one of those problem behaviors. So, Jessica, when we're talking through these behavior principles, I know we'll talk through a lot of things on this show, but can we apply all these behavior principles to adults as well as kids, or are we just talking about young children?
Oh, absolutely. Behavior principles apply to anyone, no matter the age. It also can apply to animals. And even, you know, it's widely accepted to use ABA practices in puppy training academies and even horse trainers use them. But when we think about humans, we should be using this with humans as well. So when we're talking about breaking up a school, we're not just talking about students and changing their behavior. We're also talking about the adults and changing their behavior as well. So in leadership, it's important that we're using these foundational principles and tools to support our staff and colleagues so that they can do better for kids. And we could argue that a critical component of leadership is shaping the behavior of those you lead and those who lead you.
That's really interesting. I know we talked about that quite a bit when we were talking about accountability, but that's likely something we'll talk about later on the show too, is discussing how we can apply this to leadership. But I want to switch gears a little bit because I get asked this a lot. Where do genetics come into this conversation about behavior?
All right. So before I answer your question, know that I am not a neuroscientist. I'm not a geneticist, but I read research and I really enjoy it. If you have not read the book, The Science of Consequences by Susan Schneider, I highly recommend it. It's fascinating. But we do know that only 2% of our DNA is actually coding DNA. The rest is non-coding DNA, or what's called regulatory DNA. What that means is we might have the genetics for something, but outside factors can impact those genes getting turned on or turned off, kind of like, a control panel. Even though a genetic code exists within our bodies, that code still needs instructions to be turned on. So for example, I personally am genetically predisposed to have high cholesterol. Thanks to my bacon and gravy-loving family, no offense, the food is delicious, those genes have been turned on, and now my body's genetic code for high cholesterol has definitely been activated. That being said, environmental factors play the biggest role. If my family would have had a completely different diet growing up, it might have changed my cholesterol later on. Let's face it, though, I grew up in the era of like shake and bake, hamburger helper, delivery pizza, and that did not help the slightest. But factors like the environment, genetics, and medical conditions give us context to behavior and are important to consider and take into account when we are working with behavior. We can teach behavior, though, despite those genetic factors. It is important, and hopefully people out there who are working with people with behavior problems or problem behavior are really looking at all the pieces of that puzzle. And this goes for students, adults. There's the geriatric area of ABA. There's pediatric ABA. But what we learned is we don't treat the behavior as part of a condition. We treat the behavior as the behavior while taking into consideration the other factors.
Okay, so Jessica, we have this definition of behavior, but you and I don't work in isolation. And so when we're working in teams and schools, we often in conversation will lump social, emotional, and behavior together. But are they actually the same thing, or should we be thinking about them differently?
Ooh, that's kind of a loaded question, because they are different in an academic sense, but they go together. And we need to remember that. Social emotional talks to some of the needs of a person, and behavior is a result of needs being met or not met. In schools, social emotional and behavior instruction should all be embedded all the time throughout the day. Students need to be taught how to use social skills, emotional skills, and expected behaviors in the context that these skills are used in real life. So we can have those separate lessons, and that's okay, but we actually need to be putting them into practice all day long. When needs are not being met, we'll see an increase of problem behavior. People will find a way to get their needs met, and we might not like how that is done. So we can meet those needs early on. And if we do, then we are more likely to see the appropriate behavior. So that's why we need to teach them together.
I love that. So when you're doing your behavior planning, do you try to weed out and ignore all the medical stuff, the social, emotional, trauma history, and just hone in on this behavior?
Absolutely not. And I hope other BCBAs do not as well. It adds context. So when we talked about behavior earlier and being separate, that's tricky because we need to treat the behavior, but we need all the information to make decisions on that treatment. This is where it is so important that we're collaborating with other professionals and making referrals when needed. When we were talking about building strong starts for students, it starts with the adults working together in all areas to support students. So for example, if we're going to do some sort of behavior treatment or behavior planning for a student that has a speech impairment or is limited in their communication, we want to know that. So when we're teaching this expected behavior, we're not going to expect them to ask for their needs to be met in full, complete sentences and then punish them for not doing so, right? So we want to make sure that we have appropriate expectations, it's within their ability, and it's socially valid, and it helps them and supports them.
And I'm really glad that you said that. I'm glad that we got to talk about this, because when you and I first started working together, and we may have touched on this in a previous episode, but I had this kind of baggage floating around in my mind coming from the mental health world about behavior analysis, about ABA. Just hearing stories and folks possibly misinterpreting some of the principles of ABA as ignoring some of the things that we work on in mental health, the social, emotional, and the trauma history and things like that. And so just speaking to that, to mental health professionals and other counselors, social and emotional are just two of the dimensions that make up a person. And so when you're working with a BCBA, which I hope that you are, I hope that you get the opportunities to collaborate with colleagues, it's helpful for us as the counselors to know those thoughts and the feelings that are driving behavior, because we can work on that in counseling sessions. And we also know that family history is important to know, the way the family system runs, trauma history is important to be aware of, because those things can be reinforcing behavior in ways that might not be apparent just seeing a student in a classroom. So those things are helpful to know. We also know that trauma may have likely did rewire the brain to affect those reinforcement mechanisms. And so those are things that are helpful to know so that we can bring in that perspective as well when we're working with the BCBA. But working with the BCBA also helps us when we're creating goals and to really target the behavior. So for example, let's say you were attacked by a dog as a small child. And so now you refuse to go into any home that has a dog, maybe even including your own. And you experience an immediate relief as a result of avoiding any situation with a dog. That relief is reinforcing that behavior, that avoidance behavior. And so knowing that this stems from an experience of being attacked by a dog, that's going to help guide my counseling intervention But then Jessica, as the behavior analyst, can come in and try to create a competing positive reinforcer, teach some replacement behaviors to shape the behavior so that the client can enter their house and feel comfortable doing so. So there really are ways that we're working in tandem here. And we covered a lot today, Jessica. Anything else you want to say on that before I do a recap? Because my brain needs it.
No, go for it.
Okay. So if I'm hearing on this all correctly, behavior is anything that the living person can do, not the dead person. And I'm sure we'll figure out what zombie behavior is next time. But that's for next time. Behavior is the result of a history of consequences. The outcome of a behavior is what creates the behavior, reinforces it. And there's no good and bad behavior. What matters is whether the behavior is acceptable and valid in its context. We also learned that there is a lot that gives context to our behavior, like our genetics, medical conditions, our trauma history, the social context and environment that we're in, the other emotional and social skills that we have, and our family systems. And by working in teams, we're able to process all of these factors and come up with the best goals and plans for each individual that we work with.
Yes, absolutely. And I can talk about behavior for a long time. And I will, Sarah, have to go consult my Cooper book and all my ABA resources to find some zombie behavior strategies for us, as
you mentioned. Please. I'm sure our listeners really want to know.
I'm sure. I don't know if I've ever written a zombie behavior plan, but I can feel one coming. But we really wanted to talk about this in this episode because as we're moving forward, we want to have shared language when we talk about behavior interventions and tools while we build strong starts for students. So until next time, thanks for listening. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow us at Strong Starts Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Bye, everyone.
Bye, y'all.